He put them where?
Right, we invite Rabbi Telsner to start the ball rolling.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, can I have your attention just for a few moments? First of all, welcome all for this wonderful annual. How many years have we had this Hanukkah party? I don't want to tell my age away.
In this
34.
House, it's been 14 years.
Wow, can I know? 14 years. Yada Chazoka, may we go from strength to strength. Well, since we have two hands, hopefully next year July will wait for another 14 years. And then we can have. Everyone grab a seat. It's not, you know, there's plenty of chairs around.
We just heard yesterday was David and Nicole's anniversary.
Oh, Mazel Tov.
Yes, there's a lot of
nachas,
a lot of simcha, good health.
Okay, please, everyone, grab a seat. You know, it's much easier if you sit down and enjoy yourself. I just want to give a brief overview of the Hanukkah festival, and then we'll get into more mystical and actually like the Hanukkah candles, those who haven't lit yet. The story of Hanukkah really is a very important one because it's one of the two festivals which actually is our contribution to Jewish festival. All the other festivals are biblically oriented, they mention the Bible, and the only festivals which actually we actually have founded or instituted is Hanukkah and Purim. And Hanukkah specifically, you could argue even more than Purim, because we don't actually have a book in the Bible which actually discusses what Hanukkah is all about. Now, to put things into perspective, the first temple, of course, was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and he took the Jews off to Babylon for 70 years, and then eventually the story of Purim, of Nebuchadnezzar's son Belshazzar being assassinated, and then his daughter marrying Ahasuerus, and then the whole Megillah story, and then Esther having a son called Darius, and allowing the Jews to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. The Gemara is very, very pained by the fact that when Ezra actually told the Jews to go to Jerusalem, all of them were quite well established in Babylon as doctors and lawyers and estate agents, etc., etc. No one wanted to move. Everybody was quite happy. Babylonian culture and the lifestyle was very, very pleasant and very comfortable. And no one wanted to actually move. All right, we'll go to visit Israel on Passover, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. You know, but to actually move, that's a bit, they didn't want to move. They were quite happy. And only 55,000 Jews, actually, out of millions, actually moved back to Jerusalem, which was, of course, the Talmud says, a reason why the Messiah didn't actually come in that period of history, and we're still waiting. Now, afterwards, Ezra and Nehemiah, of course, rebuilt the temple. Not as beautiful as Solomon's in the beginning because they didn't have the financial clout. And the support that they really wanted to have, they didn't actually have. About 150 years, I suspect, a bit more, give and take a few decades, into the Second Temple period, Alexander the Great comes on the scene. Now, of course, Alexander the Great, as we all know, is a Macedonian. He's called in Talmudic literature Alexander Moichtoin, the one from Macedonia. And being a missionary, not just a warrior, he starts taking over the civilized world at that time, conquering country by country, and putting in Greek culture and the Greek language and the whole lifestyle of the Greeks, and trying to change what was then the pagan atmosphere of the Europe and the Middle East. He arrives, or he sends letters beforehand to Jerusalem and asking them to realize that he's now the boss, and they say, well, they're under Persia still, backwards and forwards, they can't give up. And Alexander becomes extremely annoyed, eventually enters the land of Israel, and Jews are very scared. You know, they don't want any bloodshed, they're not interested in any wars. And what happens then is that the high priest at the time was called Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the Just, Simon the Just. And he says to the Jews, take it easy, don't get excited, we'll manage somehow. And he and a group of other priests actually go out to meet Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great seems to dismount and to be very courteous and respectful to the high priest. The high priest has a short conversation. They both take a trip into the temple. And he's given a guided tour of the temple, and Alexander the Great is extremely impressed. It seems that Alexander the Great knew that there was some money involved also in the temple, because everyone had given this half a shekel once a year, which was used for the upkeep of the temple. And, you know, money is money. People don't give it up so easily. However, the high priest said to him, you know, Alexander, why didn't we, you know, I'll give you something much more precious than money. Which, of course, is very difficult. What's more precious than money? Especially there was beautiful golden vessels, etc., in the temple. He says, I'll make sure that every young Jewish boy who's born the next year will be given the name Alexander. Now, Alexander was a very clever Jew, clever individual, and realized that that would be far more important than a bit of money. And he accepted. And as a result of that, he let the Jews continue the way they wanted to live. He let the Jews do what they wanted. And even though he wanted his statue put into the temple, the idea that every single Jewish child will be given the name Alexander made such an impact on him, which we see to this very day.
Yeah.
If you ask, you know, the most Orthodox circles, you'll find the name Alexander, and you ask yourself, well, which warrior, neither Genghis Khan or Charlemagne or Montgomery and all the rest of them, no one has names in the Jewish community, you know, except for this guy who was the only thing he had going for him was that he was a very good warrior, a very good general. Now, of course, he passes away at a very young age due to not listening to his mother's advice that you have to have a cold, one should stay home and drink hot liquids and stay under the covers. And he goes out and has a barbecue outside in the freezing cold as it is outside, gets pneumonia, and at the age of, I think it's 41 or 42, he is dead. Poor chap. Problem is, what happens to the kingdom or the estate? And of course, it's split amongst different kings, and one of them, of course, was Antiochus, who actually eventually was a very mad individual from beginning to end. He comes to the land of Israel, and he's very impressed, I must say, by what was going on. But of course, as the years went by, he was a despot, and he wanted Jews to change their lifestyle, and didn't like the way Jews don't work on Shabbat. You know, why shouldn't you work on Shabbat? You can make a living. Why waste 1/7 of the week and just sit home? He didn't like Jews being circumcised. The Olympics were then instituted, those of you who are interested in the London Olympics, who have invested some money. I hope you didn't invest too much, because it's going to be financially, I don't know what's going to happen at the end, we're going to be taxed to the hilt. We have to make another festival after the Olympics, maybe, that we've gotten out of the tax. But the idea of the beautification of the human body, the Olympics, does somehow erode the morality of that generation. And Jews find themselves in a very, very difficult predicament. Now, when Jews find themselves in a predicament, there's usually three responses. Number one, well, can't do much about it. Just we'll have to fit into the situation. Well, that's what God wants. You know, he's made it in this situation. We can't fight. We're living in an era that you have to accept certain things. And this is what God wants. End of story. Others, second opinion says, well, let's try to coexist. You know, we'll be a bit of this and a bit of that. So what's wrong with changing your name from Yankel to Jason? Or, you know, having a bit of, instead of going to shul on Shabbos, you want to have a 500-yard run backwards and forwards. And it's, you know, that the Jews who are half and half, Abyssal Dos and Abyssal Yens, a bit of this and a bit of that. And the third group says, no, no, we've got to stick to our guns. The third group being the smallest of all. And, first of all, there's a lot of politics in who is to be the high priest. Now, normally, you elect the high priest, the guy who's the most pious, most holy individual. That's the way it should be done. But in this situation, all of a sudden, you have who buys the highest bidder, and there's a whole bunch of toing and throwing who's going to be the high priest. And the whole temple, which was the spiritual center of Jewish life, somehow goes down the drain, and everything seems to be really not fulfilling the task, and Jews seem to lose their identity in their own land. It's the only time up until that period of time that Jews are actually losing their identity when they're in the same country that they should be. Many Jews don't see that what the Greeks had in mind and what the Assyrians had in mind was the eradication of Judaism. Simple as that. And they fall for many things. They're gullible. Jews are very, they don't see the reds under the beds that much. And sometimes when you're faced that way, they give in very easily, and we have a major, major crisis on our hands. Now, there was a few families who realized that something's got to be done desperately. One of them was Matishoh and his five sons, Yehuda, Makkabi, Eliezer, Shimon, and Yochanan, and they think that something's got to be done. The reason they thought so was for two. Number one, because Judaism is not just that you should have a good time, but you've got to help others. Secondly, what Antiochus was actually doing was trying to spread his Weltanschauung and his whole lifestyle to everybody, and would not let anyone live the way they wanted. And of course, he knew that if he would get the best and the richest family to do what he wanted, then everybody would follow suit. So he sent out throughout the Jewish community many altars and told everybody to bring this hog to be sacrificed and to celebrate this pagan activity. Many people couldn't care very much, and they did it. He came to a place in the north of Jerusalem called Modin, where Matisyahu, Matthias, and his brothers were there, his sons were there, and then the first beginning of the battle begins, when Jews actually say, well, this is enough, we've had enough, we're going to get our country back, we're going to throw out all the evildoers, we're going to throw out all the foreigners and the aliens, and we're going to get back to our Jewish heritage. Now, of course, it was almost suicidal. And what's phenomenal is that Jews are not in general into suicide, even though the Masada situation, saga, and then later in the 12th century, but in general, Jews are not into suicide. Remember, the Alamo is not a Jewish ideal. Jewish ideals to stay alive and to be able to do things properly. The question is, 200 years later, when the temple is being destroyed, Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai, the greatest savior of his generation, is vehemently against battle. So the question actually is asked by many commentators, so why over here, when this whole fight against the garrisons of Greece who were outnumbering and outmaneuvering the Jews a hundredfold, all of a sudden Jews started fighting? And the answer is a very, very important one, in as much as then, if God forbid, Matishoh and Yehuda HaMakkabi would not have fought the battles, then Judaism would have gone down the drain. No question about it in anyone's mind. 200 years later, Judaism is already solidly on its feet. The Mishnah was being written already, the Talmudic academies were in full swing, and no one could have destroyed Judaism then. In the Hanukkah story, we are very much aware that if the Jews would not have gotten back on the horse properly, then we wouldn't be here this evening. No question about that. And therefore, you would recognize that there's no other way. It's not a question of, you know, well, there is absolutely no other way out, and we have to fight. Even though it sounds suicidal, it sounds absolutely beyond the ways and means that Jews are able to do, but Jews never look at the regular and the normal. There is Mesiras Nefesh, there is self-sacrifice, there is unconditional surrender to the Almighty, and therefore, things have to look good. Yehuda Maccabee, we have some of the transcripts of some of his pep talks that he gave before going out to battle, and they're very good, some of them. You know, you read them a few thousand years later, and he's spot on. And he was able to somehow arouse the Jews, which was a miracle in itself. I always say that there's two miracles involved in Hanukkah. There's one miracle getting rid of the enemy, and the other miracle is waking up the Jews, because when Jews fall asleep, they sleep very well. Those of you who go to shul at 10:30, 11, you see that many Jews always walk in, you know, roomy-eyed, that they've had too much sleep. And to wake them up and to realize that, A, it's their responsibility, and they've got to get out of this deep slumber, is in itself something which is absolutely miraculous. And eventually they succeed in, number one, getting the enemy out of Jerusalem. It took another few years till they got them all out of the whole land of Israel. But then, and on the 25th, they go into the temple, they see a place which is totally defiled, contaminated, upside down, in total ruins. One of those beautiful buildings that existed within the land of Israel, maybe even the whole of the Middle East, is absolutely in shambles. So of course they went and they cleaned it up and fixed it up. But they wanted to show the Almighty immediately a appreciation for the miracle that had just taken place. So they thought, what can we do immediately? Well, one of the signs of Jewish religion is, of course, the candelabra. So they went and they set up the candelabra, and they wanted to light the menorah which was lit every day in the times of the temple service. Only problem was they wanted to use pure olive oil, which was not been contaminated or defiled. And as the rabbis tell us, they only found one small jug. And they put it into the menorah, lit the menorah, and instead of lasting for one day, it lasted for 8 days. And by that time, they were able to get new oil because it takes only 4 days to get there. But the Kohen, 4 days to come back. And as a result of that, by the 8th day, they had the regular oil, and the miracle lasted for 8 days. And they realized that the Almighty was with them. And the very fact that this miracle took place for everyone to see, for everyone to experience, was clear to all of them that the Almighty was with them, was going to help them. And this brought out a tremendous optimism amongst all the Jews at the time, and eventually cleaned up the whole place. And this lasted for about another almost 200 years, until, of course, the Romans destroyed the temple and sent us the gold is green, and we are now still, since 1800 or 1900 years ago, in Golos. Hopefully we should be leaving very soon, even tonight, hopefully. But up until then, so as a result of that, we, the Jews, instituted a festival of Hanukkah, which the rabbis tell us, number one, is Thanksgiving for the miracle of getting rid of the enemy. And that's why we say the Hallel service every day for 8 days, the whole of Hallel. We're not permitted to fast. We're not permitted to say any eulogies. And it's a festive occasion. Then we, of course, have the prayer of Avos Nisim, which is said at every time we say the Amidah and every time we say the grace after meals. And beside that, we have the candles, which we light every night. Some people do by the windowsill, some people do it on the table. It's had many ups and downs. The Hanukkah candles started out on the doorposts, and then there were some sects that didn't like that Jews were taking over the light situation, so they made problems, so they went back to the house. Today already in Israel and other places, a lot of people do it on the outside, people do it by the windowsill, people do whatever they want. And one of the great and important parts of Hanukkah is to Pirsumenisa, to actually publicize the miracle, not to keep it a private little, you know, your own self, but to actually go ahead and publicize the miracle of Hanukkah. And we do the mitzvah. There are three different ways that you can do the mitzvah. We can either do the mitzvah with one candle per night. If a person is stuck on a desert island without any discs, with 8 candles, he can do 1 candle a night and be yotzer. If he wants to do even better, he can do as many people as there are in the room or in the house. Even better, he can do it for every person and add on every night another candle. Like last night was 4, today is 5, tomorrow, please God, we'll do 6 or 7 a day. And what's interesting to know that even though you could get away with doing it very easily, the custom in all of Israel is to take on the most meticulous and most extended part of the mitzvah as possible, in recognition that God overextended himself, so we reciprocate by overextending with the actual festival of Hanukkah. And therefore, it is, of course, appropriate to light the menorah, everyone in his own home. I remember even there was a trip of about 20 Lubavitchers who went on a trip to New York by plane a few years ago. And of course, they brought with them all the menorahs, and they thought that, of course, on a plane there's no problem. When the stewardess saw what they were doing, she asked, "What are you planning on doing?" And they explained to her, "Well, we have a menorah, we're going to light." She says, "Are you guys crazy? Out of your mind?" But Lubavitcher don't stop. They went to the captain and they explained to him that we have to light candles. We're going to light candles. So he said, "Okay, I'll let you allow 1 menorah." And 1 menorah was lit on the airplane, and everyone lived happily ever after. But I advise you, please don't take a menorah on the airplanes. Do it at home first. And therefore, we celebrate by lighting the candles and singing the Aneiros Halol Kodeshein, which we have our the Jewish answer to Yasha Heifetz. Mr. Nigel will sing us a nice Nigel and put us in the mood of the Hanukkah celebration.
Mr. Nigel, it's all yours. Yasha was Jewish.
Yeah. I know he was. And so was my cousin Rudy Menuhin. But Mr. Nigel is better than all the rest of us.
Well, you play something.
Let's get in the mood.
Okay. Is there any part of
everything in this house is
loaded. Tiam,
Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad, most probably in 1781, 2 or 3, or maybe even later. I'm not sure. I can't hear you.
1780,
where are we up to now?
2000.
200 or something. Yeah. Move around there.
Is there anyone who didn't manage to, who didn't like coming to them?
Everyone left. Still have one, at least
have one. So we'll have one. Still have one burning.
There was a beautiful story happening in Kiev two nights ago. I don't know if you've heard it. You know, in many of these cities, we try to have menorahs, just like having Golders Green Road. So in Kiev, they put up a menorah in the city center, and they invited the associate mayor to come and to light the candle. So he was on top of the cherry picker, so they asked him to light the shamas, which that candle you light the other candles. So they asked him, why can't I light the other ones? So the chap there was very blunt and said, because only Jews light the other candles. So he stopped for a second, but I'm Jewish. It was the first time in history that anybody in Kiev found out that this chap was Jewish.
Yeah.
So they let him light the whole candles and began to cry publicly, and he lit all the candles. No one had known the guy was Jewish. So that's why you got to go on top of a 20-foot cherry picker to find out that you're Jewish. Huh? Especially in Kiev, you know. Mm-hmm. There is a kosher pizza shop down there. Yes, right next to the beautiful new shul, the Brodetsky Shul, which has been renovated by some South American. Beautiful. Well, he didn't do that shul. Right next door to the pizza shop. We were walking there, a few gentlemen with, you know, beards, and then a guy from the Spiegel stopped us and said, "Can I take a picture?" "I don't take a picture, but I want a copy. Never send it to us." But he took a picture. He said, "I haven't seen in Germany some beards walking around like that for many years." He took a picture of us right opposite the shop. But he didn't put it in, I think. Well, at least, mm-hmm. I suppose he did. And I read it at the Spiegel every week, so I wouldn't mind. Mm-hmm. We have another round. What can you play? You mean Hashem? You do that? Hallelujah. I play
you. You don't think it could happen with this mayor here?
What is this? He's having a menorah lighting tomorrow. I think.
What's
this? Donuts.
Yeah, I'll take half.
His wife is.
Okay.
Half. Is he married?
Is that a knife? I'll tell you what. I'll take a half one. Take one and I'll put half. Two halves. Thank you. You've got the serviette thing.
You get a shamash and that lights all of the oil.
I mean, that's important.
Yeah, but there's some oil already in the
No, you don't need that. Take that out.
You take that out. Joe,
use a regular candle.
He says you don't need to put that one in there.
The one is with the shamash is usually a shiva, usually a beeswax. It's not an actual
wick.
In the temple, he's right. In the temple, there was only wicks. But we have the candle, which is shamash is a regular candle.
Yeah, I tried to do it with that.
Full of oil.
Yeah, it was oil. You can't do it. You have to use a candle. What's the idea of that? It's a dummy or what?
How much? How many candles are they give you?
You got the full set. It's not a candle with the oil. With the oil.
It's all oil.
It's all oil. They only give you 36. They give you full shamash.
And they got the shamash as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. They sell it like a triangle.
But they only have 36. You don't have
the Shabbos. But I'm saying the same thing. Like by adding, you diminish.
It confused me, and I didn't know what to do. So we had to use the candle.
No problem. Well, it doesn't matter what you use as the Shabbos.
How you eat.
Right, okay, we are going to explore a little bit of a discourse, a little bit of a mimer about Hanukkah, because the whole idea of Hanukkah is the miracle of the oil. Now, Torah is compared to many different things. Torah is compared to water, because water flows from a high place down to a low place. And that's what the Torah is doing. It's flowing from Mount Sinai down to the world. It is flowing from the hidden recesses above the realm of black fire on white fire, which is the Torah HaKadumah, the primeval Torah. And the Torah flows down from there. And of course, Torah is also compared with Eish, fire, Eish HaTorah, the fire of Torah. Torah is, however, there is another dimension of Torah. If we speak about the water of Torah, that is the revealed dimension of Torah. That's the revealed teachings which instruct us how to make a Jewish life, that when you have a home, you put mezuzot on the doors. And when it comes to Hanukkah, we light Hanukkah lamps, and all the different dimensions of Jewish thought, whether it's the mitzvot from the Torah or the mitzvot midrabanan from the sages, like Hanukkah is one of the seven mitzvot which the sages added, like reading the Megillah, Erevin, Shabbat candles, brachot, various other things, seven mitzvot altogether, so that with the 613 mitzvot plus the seven midrabanan, we have 620, which is the numerical value of Saul. 620 is Keter, as Rabbi Telsa says, Tof Resh Kof. 620. So Keter, which is the top of the system of the Svirot, just as we merge with the infinite, and really the mitzvot are a way of enabling the infinite radiance of Ein Sof to flow down into our lives, into the physical world. And so there we have the mitzvah. So that is the water of Torah, telling us what are the actual mitzvah that we should carry out. Then we have the wine of Torah, Yeno Shel Torah, the Yeno Shel Torah, the wine of Torah. And we also have the idea of Shemek, of oil, the oil of Torah. And the interesting thing about oil is that oil, so the wine of Torah is a mystical dimension, and the oil of Torah is an even further level of the mystical dimension of Torah. And there's the interesting thing about oil is that every substance, you can produce an oil from it, whatever it is, nuts, corn, you squeeze the substance and you will extract an oil. There is somewhere or other, there is a dimension of oil. And so in the same way, every single thing in existence has within it some dimension of Torah thought, and especially there is a halachic dimension as well. Everything in existence can be looked at in a halachic way. Is you're in a barn. Is this barn duty-bound to have a mezuzah, or it's not duty-bound to have a mezuzah? So everything can be looked at in halachic terminology. And that's Rabbi Soloveitchik's book, Halachic Man, defines the whole of life in terms of looking at things in a halachic way. And then we go a step beyond that as well, where we look at the spiritual dimension which is there in everything. So everything has got oil. And the other thing about oil is that oil seeps in everywhere. If you spill any oil, it soon gets into everything. So the oil seeps into everything. So everything has got this spiritual dimension. And so particularly now when it's Hanukkah, and we've had a l'chaim, if anyone would like a bit more l'chaim, please help yourself, or donuts, or the other beautiful commodities which we have over here in gashmiut, in material terms. So let us spice it with a little bit of spiritual teaching. And so we are looking at a discourse which was said in 1977. It was actually said Motzei Shabbat Miketz. We're coming to the Shabbat of Miketz now. It's going to be the second Shabbat of Hanukkah for us. And at that year, 1977, unfortunately the Rebbe had a heart attack, and with tremendous dedication, which was a great example to everyone else, he insisted on teaching. And despite this fact that he had the heart attack, and to the wonder of his doctor, doctors who were very surprised at this, and he would do this Motzei Shabbat on Saturday night, and here in London would be something like 2:30 in the morning. People would be able to come and listen to the Rebbe speaking, given the 5-hour time difference from New York. And so this discourse begins off from a passage in the Talmud, and that is the passage that we have here. And it's in fact what Rabbi Telzer quoted before, Tanu Rabbanan mitzvot Chanukah. Now, in the English, it's our rabbis taught the precept of Chanukah. Let's just have a look at it in the Talmudic passage, which is about a third of the way down. It's just level with the word Vahamahadrin in the Tosafot. On the right-hand side of the page, you've got the word Vahamahadrin. And so if you follow that into the word, into the actual text, you've got Tanu Rabbanan. Okay. Tanu Rabbanan, mitzvot Chanukah neru shebeisa. The mitzvah of Chanukah is, as Rabbi Telzner said, one candle for each person and his household. One candle's enough. V'amahadrin, and those who are more strict and want to do it more beautifully, ne'elechol echad ve'echad, there's a candle for each person in the household. V'amahadrin, minamahadrin, and if you want to be even more careful, ve'shamay oimrim, ve'shamay say, yoim rishon madlik shmoin mikan ve'elach poiches v'hoilech. Ve'shamay say, on the first day, night of Hanukkah, we light 8 lights, and then we go less and less. Beis Hillel say, on the first night we light one. Mikan ve'elach moisef ha'olech, from then on we increase. Oma Ula said, plegi botrei amurai, there were two sages of the Talmudic sages, b'marova, in the west, which means in Israel. Rabbi Yosef barabin v'rabbi Yosef barzebeda. They're arguing, these two sages, these later sages, they are after Hillel and Shammai, and now they're discussing what are the reasons of Hillel and Shammai. Chaduma once said, Tama de Beis Shammai keneged yomim hanichnosin. The reason of Beis Shammai, who says you light 8, is because you've got 8 days to come. You look at the potential, what is there to come? But Tama de Beis Hillel keneged yomim ha-yotzim. And the reason for Beis Hillel is you look at the actual. How many days have you actually got? Tonight is 5, so you have 5 lights. V'chadrama, but the other one said, no, they argue on a different thing. Tama de Beis Shammai keneged korei ha-chog. The reason for Beis Shammai is because of the bulls which were offered on Sukkot. Now the bulls that were offered on Sukkot, which actually add up to 70 altogether, relating to the 70 nations of the world, the bulls offered on Sukkot were decreasing number of bulls every day. So Beit Shammai is saying the same way that on Sukkot you have a decreasing number of bulls every day, so when you have the lights of Chanukah, you go down every single day. And Beit Hillel say, no, a different reason, the Ma'ilim Bakoidish Re'moridim, you go up in holy things, you go up, you don't go lower, so therefore you wouldn't start with 8 and go down to 7, but you'd start with 1 and you go up to 2. Okay. Now we're going to move, that's from the Gemara, and we're now going to move into the Maimah, into the discourse which illuminates this little piece of Gemara, the Maimah, which we're going to have the Maimah, which will illuminate a little bit. Hopefully we should be able to hear it. And so first of all, we're going to have the Maimah Niggun played by Yossi. Oh, yo.
Kambaya, yo, yada, yada, yo.
Our sages learn mitzvah ne Chanukah, the mitzvah of the Chanukah lamp. Beit Shammai omrim yom rishon madlik shmone. Beit Shammai say on the first day you light 8. Mikam ve'elach pochet v'holech, and then from then on you go down. Or Beit Hillel omrim yom rishon madlik achat. Beit Hillel say on the first night you light 1. Mikam ve'elach mosik v'holech, and from then on you go up. Tama, the Beit Shammai, the reason of Beit Shammai is Keneged Parei Achag, corresponds to the bulls of the festival of Sukkot. The Tama, the Beit Hillel, and the reason of Beit Hillel is the mile in the Kodesh, is that we go higher in a sacred thing. Now, Rabbi Shneur Zalman, he comments on this. Ma inyan ner Chanukah le Parei Achag? What's the relationship of the light of the Chanukah lamp to the bulls of Sukkot? Or bevchat lefi ma shekatuv, and especially according to what the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, said, shegam Beit Hillel lo plegi elu meshum demalim mekodesh. Beit Hillel actually agree with Beit Shammai. They also think that there's a connection with Sukkot. The only thing is, Beit Hillel say we can't go down in holy things; you have to go up. So therefore, as far as the Tzemach Tzedek explains, both Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel really see a connection between Chanukah and the Parei and the bulls of Sukkot. And what is this relationship? Now there's a connection which is made in a number of places. The connection between Chanukah and Sukkot, he shesneim hem shmoni yamim. Both of them are 8 days long. Now the number 8 relates to something which is higher than Hishtashlut. See, would you like to explain that concept?
Normally we have, for example, the 7-day week. That's the norm. You start from Sunday, then you go to Shabbat. But when you get, however, the 8th, that is beyond. I mean, anything which is the normal, the regular situation as it works, and then you have something which goes beyond. And also, you have this also in human behavior. There are 7 different attributes that a person has: love, severity, activity, etc. And then you have that which is above, which we think, which is something which is, let's say, delight or will. Will is not a specific, like kindness, you share something with someone else. Will encompasses the whole of the human personality. So therefore, whenever we speak about Shmini, we say it is beyond. There is the normal, say a certain, for example, a certain amount, and there's that which is given, which is beyond and goes above and is higher than the regular. So you have, for example, creation. Creation has a limited setup. God might have created stones with its amount of power, and the plant kingdom with its amount of power, and the human kingdom with its amount of power. And then you have something which goes beyond all of that, which is totally above. That's why the word shmini also comes from the word fat, shamen.
shemen, the same concept of the heaviness, which is norm, which is beyond the regular and the norm.
Right, now if we go on with this paragraph, we're going to skip to the bottom of the page, just three lines up from the bottom. V'gam tzarich lahavin, we also have to understand, mash mitzvata shel ner Chanukah, why the mitzvah of the Chanukah lamp, hi mishetishka chama, is when the sun is setting, has set. That's when we light the Chanukah lamp. The Chanukah lamp is in the darkness. It's coming into the darkness. Now the Chanukah lamp represents the menorah which was in the temple, the golden menorah, and the golden menorah in the temple wasn't lit at the as it was getting dark. It was lit earlier on in the day. The nerot, so this is a question. The nerot hamikdash hidliku miplaga mincha. The light in the temple of the menorah was lit earlier. Shaul rovia kodem ashkia, at least an hour and a quarter before sunset. Since the Chanukah lamp is because of the miracle that was in the temple, with the menorah of the temple, as we explained before, the whole idea of lighting the menorah, you would think that they would make the mitzvah, the sages would have enacted the mitzvah of Chanukah, to be something similar to the way it is in the temple. The same time that you light the menorah in the temple, that will be the time that we light the menorah, the Chanukah menorah. But in fact we don't. V'lama mitzvatahi dafka mishetishka achama. Why is the mitzvah of the Chanukah menorah specifically when the sun is setting, or has set? Paragraph bet, to unukudat ha-biyuch b'zeh. Now the nukudah of this explanation, the inyanam shel neirot Chanukah hu lahair et hachoshech. The basic theme of the light of the Chanukah lamp is to illuminate the darkness. Dehine anes de Chanukah haya la'acharei shenichnasu ha'yavanim lahir. The miracle of Chanukah was after the Greeks had entered the temple, the timu kol hashmanim shebehem, and they defiled all the oil. Shatigbor et hachoshech, this tremendous power of darkness, haita ad kedei kach, was so strong. Velo rak shenichnasu lehechal v'timu, not only did they enter the temple and defile it, as she described with the hogs that was offered on the altar. Eil shetimu gam et kol hashmanim shebehechal, they looked out for all the oil in the temple and they defiled that. Now the shemen hibchinat kodesh. The oil represents sanctity. Kodesh mila begarme. Kodesh, sanctity, something which is in itself, sui generis, a thing which is significant in itself, which doesn't mix with anything else. Bedugmas ha-shemen, like the oil, shetzaf al gabi kol ha-mashkim ha-inu mitarevi mahen. Oil doesn't mix with other liquids. It always floats on top. And so sanctity, sacredness, is something which is separate. And so the mizemu van shezet shetimut kol hashmanim shebehechel. The fact they defiled all the oil in the temple. Noger od yoter mizeh shetimut hahechel. It's even worse than the fact they defiled the temple itself. Was defiling all the oil. It's as if they reached some kind of inner dimension within the temple. Then they're defiling that. Av shekdushat hahechel idag analit ba'eser kedushot. Even though the sanctity of the temple is very exalted, there's 10 degrees of Kedusha. See, do you want to elaborate on those?
We know that in the sanctity you have Israel itself, then you have Jerusalem, then you have the Temple Mount, and then you have the different courtyards till you get to the Holy of Holies. So altogether you have 10, and each one is holier than the other. So for example, in the whole of Israel, everybody can hang out. In Jerusalem, for example, within the walled city, most people can hang out. If a person, God forbid, is a leper, he's got to go out. If a person has other tumot, then he has to go out. But he can, those who are lesser degrees of impurity can stay. Now, when you get to the actually courtyards, the more, the higher you go physically also, because the steps going up, the lesser degree that everyone can go there. And then you have, for example, the Holy of Holies, is the priest only goes there once a year. So therefore, you have these 10 different levels which go from the land of Israel up until the Holy of Holies. And each one, you have more restrictions. They actually found in one of the excavations on the Temple Mount
that I think it was non-Jews are not permitted beyond this point. It was actually in Greek, written on the wall. As I've seen the actual writing, that you can go beyond that. And for example, even if you were a Kohen, but if you had a certain level of defilement, then you weren't allowed to go into the Heichal and the Ulam, for example, to light the candelabra.
So there we have, you see the idea, the temple itself is very sacred. It's one of the Heichal is the penultimate level. The only one higher than the Heichal is the Holy of Holies. But nonetheless, what this discourse is saying, that a worse degree of defilement was the finding of the oil. The oil was kept in a certain storeroom in the temple. And I think in the diagrams of the temple, there's usually one area which it tells you this is where they kept the oil. And it's not in the Holy of Holies. It's somewhere in the Ezrat Nashim, I think, that sort of area. There's a place where they kept the oil. But the defining of the oil was an extra negative, terrible thing that happened to us, that they defiled the oil. It's as if they entered into the very deep dimension of what it is to be a Jew, to learn Torah, the spirituality of the Jew. That was what was being defiled by the Greeks. And you can see the significance of this. That after the Jewish people entered the temple and purified the temple, in order to be able to light the menorah, it wasn't enough to have conquered the temple and repurified it. They needed a miracle of the oil. In order to light the menorah, they needed a miracle. Matril, now the first level of the miracle. Matril mehanes, beginning with the miracle. Shematzu pach echad shemen tahor. They found one flask of pure oil. Chatum b'chotamo shel kohen gadol, which is sealed with the seal of the high priest. That's an amazing thing. Finding this flask of pure oil. And this is really like the flask of pure oil within the Jew. The flask of pure oil within the Jew, like Sri told the story of the mayor of Kiev, who suddenly revealed after years and years, how old was he? So many years this person lived under the communists, and suddenly he's revealed, and he's got to be the mayor, and suddenly he's revealing that he's Jewish. It's the most incredible thing. Now there is that quality burning inside him. That a friend of mine had a very, very close friend going back many, many years, but a non-Jew, a Christian. And for many years, they weren't so much together, but somehow their lives follow similar paths. This one became a therapist, that one became a therapist. They did this, they did that. All the time, somehow, they were doing similar things. And then this lady, her mother passed away. She's about 60 now. Her mother passed away, unfortunately, and going through the papers, she finds out her mother's Jewish. She didn't know, and it's a whole complete shock to her, discovering that she's actually Jewish. Now, that's that's the time bomb, as it were, which is in the heart of every Jew, and it's the flask of pure oil, which sometimes bursts into flames unexpectedly. That's so there is this the first miracle, and the way it describes it here, what is this flask of pure oil which is sealed with the seal of the high priest? Or Ein Sof, the radiance of the infinite, Shelamayla Meishtalshelut, which is higher than the downchaining of worlds. So there's the downchaining of worlds, the seven Sfirot, the 7 days, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, the whole of existence. And beyond that is the radiance of the infinite. That's what this flask of pure oil is. Shelegabe orze, in relation to this radiance of the flask of pure oil, gam choshech lo yachshich. Darkness is not dark. Nothing can hide this radiance. Once this radiance shines, it shines. Vadarabah, and on the contrary, orze meyet ha choshech, this radiance, this dimension of radiance which is there in that flask of pure oil, has got such a power to illuminate that it maya et hachoshech, it illuminates the darkness, shegam hachoshech yalia, that the darkness itself will shine. That you no longer have the duality of the light and the dark, you have a radiance which shines into the darkness, and the darkness starts shining on its own back. Vahavaya, b'tosedvav, yagia chashki, and God will illuminate my darkness. That's the verse in Psalms about the whole idea of light and darkness, and when, and there's a long discourse, a beautiful discourse by Rabbi Shneur Zalman and later Chabad leaders about this, the idea that there is the radiance and the darkness, and you have the relationship that a little bit of light, ma'at or doche habe choshech, a little bit of light pushes away a lot of darkness, but you've still got a polarity. And then you go beyond that polarity to the darkness itself shining, and you have a higher level of unity. And that is why the Chanukah lamp is the mitzvah when the sun is setting. We want the darkness, because the whole idea of the Chanukah lamp is to illuminate the darkness and make the darkness shine. And that's why there are eight lights of the Chanukah lamp. Because the number 8 indicates our pinus shel ha'mayla mishkan shlut, a level which is higher than the downchaining of worlds. Shemitzad b'china zu, it's only when you rise to this level, dafka, only from there, efsha lahayir gamet ha'choshech, we're able to illuminate also the darkness. So would you like to play a niggun, and then maybe we'll come to another little spot of this? So would you like to look over the next paragraph? Well, Yossi. I don't know, a deep melody so that we can go deep into the... We're illuminating the darkness here, so Yossi's going to cook up a melody which will do that.
The Rebbe continues as follows: Beer or Inyan Ba'avedas Adam. All this we've been discussing, historical background. But we have to know that everything that happens in Jewish history has a lesson and a message and is a description of the person's life from beginning to end. So therefore, what is the story of Hanukkah and the discussion with the oil and everything this entails? What is a direct connection with our lives daily and with our religious behavior? The Zesha Yvonim Tumas Hashmanim Shebehechol. Why did they actually go and defy the oil? They should have thrown it out. You don't want the Jews to light the menorah, so pick up the oil and throw it out, so the Jews would have no oil, no light, and finish out the story. No, they didn't do that. They left all the oil there, and I suppose it was very well the shelves, just like Heaven Sainsbury, vegetable oil, this oil, that, everything was straight. But you saw that it had been defiled. So what was the purpose of it all?
So the purpose is very simple, he says. Mipnesha kol milchamtam. What was the war that the Greeks were attacking the Jews? What was the undermining force here? It was a spiritual battle, had nothing physically, maybe that in the note on the bottom writes, that was a result of the spiritual battle. But the main thrust was the spiritual battle that they wanted the Jews to change their lifestyle. They didn't want to give it to the Jews because otherwise you have a very nice country. You're going to give it to the people? There was no such thing at that time. The main thrust of their whole fight was to make the Jews forget God's Torah. The Jews should stop acting and behaving as Jews. Now, what is this? So that's number one. That's one level. That Jews should leave God as it was, forsake the religion of their forefathers, and forsake mitzvahs, finish, and take on the Greek culture and the Greek ideals and whatever Greece had to offer. And then he goes another thing. And this fight, this battle, they went ahead and they wanted the Jews to drop the performance of mitzvahs and commandments. It wasn't just that they didn't want Jews to do certain activities. They didn't want Jews to do the activity because it was godly. I mean, to give charity, they didn't mind. Give charity, no question, but you're giving charity because the Almighty has commanded you to give charity. To emulate, to imitate the Almighty by being kind and good. That they didn't want. They wanted out of the equation. Divorce your activity from the source of the commander. They wanted that we should forget it's God's Torah. It's wisdom. Forget about any spiritual. It is partially a logical sequence of events that you have to honor your father and mother. You have to give charity. You have to be nice to an old lady and cross a blind person in the street. But forget about the godly level, the spiritual level that its source is. Teirasecho dafka, that is your Torah, that is God's Torah. And let's put it all into the human format. The Greeks didn't mind. The Jews were an intellectual people and they were involved in wisdom and they were involved in study and learning. That didn't bother them. She saw the Yilmud HaTorah. Ela sherotza shelimud HaTorah rak mitzad haseichel shebeTorah. That the whole idea of study was not the actual level of Torah as we have it, but the intelligence and the logic and the rationale behind it, what man can understand. Because there's great wisdom in the Torah. And the whole battle was as he saw that the Jews should forget the underlying point that Torah is godly. That the wisdom we study and that which we carry out is of a godly level. Some things we can understand, some things we don't understand. Some things are logical and some things are not so logical. That which we are learning is not our wisdom, it's not our intelligence, it's something which is directly given from God as a revealer at Sinai. Well, there's a mitzvah, the same thing applies to mitzvahs. You don't do a mitzvah because God told you to do it. You do a mitzvah because your intelligence and your rationale and your logic dictates that you should do it. Thou shalt not murder. So you need to have God to tell you thou shalt not murder. It's a logical thing that you don't go around murdering people. Well, maybe today it's not. You know, today you don't go killing people anyway. Shemelchemes ha'ivon, the fight of the Greeks, are connected to elokushim, and it's the spirituality, the godliness that was in the commandments. Mashamitzas ha'mitzoyno yizborta, we have to, this is the will of God. That every mitzvah that a Jew does, every act that a Jew performs, this is what God wants us to do. That they wanted to get to totally eradicate from the essence of the Jew. Yours. Constantly in the prayer we speak about your Torah, your mitzvahs. That which is those commandments that are yours and were given by us. In mitzvahs itself, we of course have three categories. We have mitzvahs which we call chukim, mishpatim, and edus. Eidus is commemorative mitzvahs. Shabbat, the Almighty created the world in 6 days, he rested on the seventh. So we commemorate that. We commemorate Pesach. We commemorate Tukos out of Egypt. We commemorate Shavuos, he gave us a Torah. Those mitzvahs are things that man can understand. Mishpatim, laws, don't steal, don't rob, don't murder, don't destroy. And everybody can understand. You don't have to be a Jew to understand it. And then you have chukim mitzvahs, which we don't have the foggiest idea why we do them. We have no idea
why you slaughter an animal, you sprinkle the blood, you do this, you do that. What's the meaning? Kill an animal any way you want. Why does it have to be done in a manner that costs three times as much as everyone else? Shall mitzvahs the eidus u'mishpatim lias mitzvahs sichleis, that these idea that mitzvahs are that which one can understand. They also kept these commandments. The Greeks never said that you should live like Tarzan. They realized you should live an intelligent, logical, rational life with respect and honor. The essence were those mitzvahs that made no sense whatsoever. For example, the concept of circumcision. They fought against it. What do you need it for? Man is created perfect. What are you tampering with, man? Why should you play around? 8-year-old baby has no wisdom to ask or to deny, to agree or not to agree. You have no right to go ahead and do it. That is something which is way beyond, or even the concept that has been mentioned before, but the hogs. What is the difference between a hog and a cow? I once had this. I was standing on Hyde Park Corner with Mr. Glick Oliver Sholom. He used to always spend Hanukkah in Spain. So we were standing there, and we asked the gentleman to come into the mitzvah tank to put on films. He said, Rabbi, I want to ask you something. He says, what is the difference between a hog and a cow? Why do you say a hog you're not allowed to eat, and a cow you are allowed to eat? Well, one is more intelligent than the other, one is a member of the Chreis of the Oxford Union or something. Well, what's the difference between the two? This is an animal, that's an animal. This has 4 feet, that has 4 feet. Why should there be anything? I don't understand. He says, why this meat you accept and this meat you don't? And I said, you know what, you're absolutely right. Logically and rationally, I can assure you, Immanuel Kant would not have been able to explain to you why you do it. The only thing God said, this animal is permitted, this animal is not permitted, that's why I do it. I have no reason whatsoever that I can actually tell you why I do it. The only reason I tell, because it's what God wants. And this the Greeks were totally against from beginning to end. There's no such thing. If you don't understand something, you don't keep it. And that which you understand, you do keep. And that's why they didn't like, in general, not working on Shabbat, because you're losing a day. 1/7 of the week's wages go down the drain. That's a terrible thing. The kevon she'oifen kiyumam, the chol mechamtam is that the rak, and they asked the Jew, why are you performing a mitzvah? So if the Jew would have turned around and said, I'm performing the mitzvah because it makes a sense logically. But they couldn't say that, because the red heifer doesn't make sense, and mixing wool and linen doesn't make sense, and then mixing meat and milk doesn't make sense. So you guys say, well, it's rational. Why isn't it rational? It isn't rational, because milk on itself is permitted, meat on itself is also permitted, so therefore why shouldn't you be able to mix the two together? That's what they were against. There's nothing beyond my intelligence. Excuse me?
Symbolically it makes sense.
Complete sense symbolically.
What do you mean symbolically? In what context?
The original commandment is not to cut the kid in its mother's milk.
Correct, correct.
Right, which is what the heathen tribes did in command.
Correct. So what was wrong with that? But the Torah never. See, if the Torah was said, there are. I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're. But there are commandments, for example, that said, don't behave this, because this is what the heathens did beforehand. But on this mitzvah, the word of the heathens is not mentioned. It is complete in the middle of Mishpatim, when we're talking about things which have nothing to do with the rest of the world, that mitzvah is thrown in.
But it seems to disrespect God's creation.
Why?
By just taking anything, and by not being conscious that the animal has had the calf. Mm. And somehow there's something which desecrates.
Why?
Well, Dafka cooking the kid in its own mother's milk.
But the prohibition is not its own mother's milk. The prohibition is any milk in meat.
No. The original
blood, which represents death, with milk, which represents life.
Well, that is already the mystical later which we have developed. Yeah. You're absolutely right. But at the end of the day, in its essence, when you ask why, if each one by itself is permitted, I mean, you could say the same thing. I think I heard this from Tali many years ago. In electricity, you also have the same thing. The two wires have to go separate. The minute they mix, you have an explosion. You're right, there's certain things that on their own may be correct. But the very fact that, for example, all of the laws, for example, go a step further, you can have coconut milk with the meat. But you can't have regular milk. Or you can have, for example, kosher milk you can have with a non-kosher animal. Or non-kosher milk, you cannot have. You can have it in a non-kosher animal. That means there's so many different parameters within the mitzvah that it doesn't fit into any logical sequence. Either everything has to be that way, but you have these different split personalities, almost schizophrenic halachic decisions, that this is permitted, this is not permitted, this is not, you know, if it's cold or if it's not, and all of them just are totally illogical.
I think what I'd like to do is take the ball now, if you don't mind, Steve. Thank you very much.
Certainly.
And move back to the discussion we had at the beginning about Keter, because the very highest level connecting the Ein Sof with the downchaining of the world, and Keter is 600, and that really represents the mitzvah. And in fact, they're described as the 600 channels whereby we connect with the divine and we move upwards to the divine. We connect with the divine. And to move from this discourse to another discourse, I'm sorry, I've only got one of these pictures, which is a diagram of the Chanukah lamp. And I'm going to show you. You see, you've got the vessel of the Chanukah lamp, and which has got oil in it. Then you've got the wick, and then you've got the flame which is burning at the wick. Now, okay, so that's a very straightforward thing. We have the vessel, the oil in the vessel, the wick, and then the flame which is burning from the wick. Now, the Zohar speaks about this as an image for a person. The person is being represented by this model of the lamp. And in a teaching by Rabbi Shneur Zalman and his son Rabbi Dovber, it's expanded into the whole concept of the Chanukah lamp and the way in which this represents the individual in their service of God. So the wick is actually the person, and the quest of life is to be able to have the flame burning around us, the illumination, a divine illumination which is there with us in our daily lives, and we take it into the different details of practical life that we have. How are we able to do that? We do that through the presence of the oil. Now, the oil are, in this image, the oil are the mitzvot. They are the mitzvot which come ultimately from beyond reason. They come from Keter, which is higher than Chochmah and Binah, higher than wisdom and understanding. And so therefore the mitzvot, and the question why the mitzvah should be exactly in this way or exactly in that way. In fact, that page of Talmud we were looking at, there's several pages of Talmud talking about the Chanukah lamp. Exactly where it should be and whether it matters what kind of oil or what kind of wick for the Shabbat lamp. There is a chapter of Mishnah which talks about how you have to be very careful about what kind of oil and what kind of wick. Now, does that apply to a Chanukah lamp? There's a whole discussion. And so every detail is significant. Why are these details so significant? Because they are like a melody, which is connecting us to the infinite and expressing the infinite here in this world. And the way in which that is manifest is by this radiant flame. Now, you see that the flame has two parts. Like any flame, if we look at the Chanukah flames over there, you can see that there is a dark part of the flame in the middle and then the bright part of the flame. So that's also here in this diagram. The dark part of the flame is where the fire is eating away at the wick. That's the level of self-restraint. There's certain mitzvot that you need self-restraint. For example, there is, I'm not sure if it's exactly one of the 613 mitzvot, but if we transgress, we're doing something very seriously. Mustn't lose your temper. Is it one of the 613?
The mitzvah is to lose your temper.
Well,
that's what Jews do all the time.
Yeah, we're not supposed to lose our temper. I'm not sure that there is actually, mitzvah 426, not to lose your temper, but it's certainly forbidden to lose one's temper, and in fact, losing one's temper is considered as bad as serving idols. Very serious. And the Kabbalistic sages instituted a tikkunim, that if you do lose your temper, you have to fast
151
what?
Fasts. In order to
exiate. Diet.
This is before anorexia was popular.
He started anorexia, what do you mean?
Well, it's Kabbalistic anorexia. But who always lost
for an ascetic.
Not in sequence.
No,
No.
Over
10 years.
Yeah, it could be over.
And only in the winter, the short nights, or 2 half days.
No. Alternatively, you can give 18 coins per day in charity. But it still adds up to quite a sum. So anyway, so there you have. So in order to not lose your temper...
I don't think that's an equivalent.
Of the giving of charity.
What, 161?
Fasting and giving coins. They ought not to be equivalent.
Okay, well, we can add your comment. There's always room for another comment in the market. So, you know, that's how books are written. You know, you've got the middle, then you've got the outer edge, then the inner edge, then the outer edge, and the bottom, and then... So in order not to lose your temper, you sometimes have to hold yourself back. Now that is like the flame burning away at the wick. You're holding yourself back from something forbidden. Very, very hard. Most people don't manage. But that's the unless you have a very good sense of humor like Rabbi Telsner, then you're able to switch the whole thing around and there's no problem. But for most people it's a much more difficult path. So there is that level of restraint which is there burning away at the wick, and in fact even sometimes doing the mitzvah can be a very big effort. You have to go to this kind of trouble and that kind of trouble. You know, sometimes people who have a difficulty, a friend of mine is flying from one country to another, he has to get on the plane before you're allowed to light the Hanukkah lamp, and the plane lands at a time after when it's too late already, like the next morning. So he changed his flight so as to come into another city and be able to have a few hours in that city at a time that he can light a Hanukkah lamp, and he organized with the Chabad Shliach in that city that he can go to his house, light the Hanukkah lamp, go straight back to the airport and go on his journey. Just imagine, you know, just that complicated schlep in order, Baruch Hashem, to fulfill the mitzvah of Hanukkah. Now all that's the dark flame which is burning away at the wick, costing money, you know, how much it costs to change the flight and the taxi and all the other things involved. But the result is the bright flame. There's one little flame left there to illustrate this part of the story. The bright flame, that's the love of God that is expressed in our lives. And the love which is there in a person's relationship with God is something extremely beautiful. Because our task as human beings here in this world, we have most intense feelings, the possibility of most intense feelings, very intense, in the musical instruments in the Lipkin home and Yossi playing violin, manifest to us the way in which we are really, we're just ready to resound, to respond in all kinds of different ways. The dwelling of God in the lower world is that there in these strings of our feelings, the melody of our hearts, there should be a divine melody. Not just the beautiful aesthetic melody of the Greeks, not just the sensuous melodies that there might be somewhere else, but a spiritual melody which is being expressed in our hearts and expressing this connection of God with God here in this world. So that is the Hanukkah flame. And in fact, our discourse goes on to talk about the way that there was a harp in the temple which had 7 strings, and in the time of Mashiach the harp will have 8 strings, and so therefore there we are moving towards that. So I wish everyone a very happy Hanukkah, and we thank David and Nicole very, very much for hosting us so wonderfully all the way through the season in our Aleph group Shiurim, which with the help of God are going to begin again on the 9th of January with the help of Hashem, and then we will be again listening to exploring together a Maimah Hasidus, which you can now hear. They've all been put up back on the web in the proper way, www.chabadresearch.org, click audio and you have our little shiurim together. Thank you very much. And also very, very great thanks to Yossi Nigan who is wonderful, faithful, coming with us, and including and playing. Yes, his name is Z. Yes. Almost everyone in the family is a musician.
You didn't answer the question. Oh, I didn't hear. Yes. You said, why didn't the Greeks throw out the oil?
Family name.
But that wasn't the purpose. The purpose was that we should.
That's really getting the name
of the file.
They wanted to make us into Greeks. Wasn't enough to make money on the oil.
We should take that defile oil and do it the way they want it, basically. Forget about the spirituality of oil, of the whole business. But they were a mixture of Greek and Assyrian. Different as it is today, it's not the same as it is. But it was certainly the Greek, Athens, Aristotle, the whole
time gadget. No, it took 8 days to make new work.
It's 4 days a trip each way.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is the menorah had seven branches.
Well,
so they only actually needed enough oil.
To go up in order to go up.
Yeah.
It's not about the branches.
Yeah. But the point that that's also brought out in the Maimon. That the seven branches are transcended by the mitzvah of Hanukkah.
It's an extra one.
And in fact, the mitzvah of Hanukkah is eternal. The seven branches of the menorah, unfortunately, when the temple was destroyed, so we can't light the menorah in the temple. But the mitzvah of Hanukkah, which expresses our mesirut nefesh, our self-sacrifice, and the whole process which brought about that miracle, that is there all the time. And so we have that, even though we don't have the temple, we have the mitzvah.
So we add to it, actually,
yes.
What you're saying.
But yes. We go to a higher level. Seven is the cycle,
right?
And eight is beyond the cycle. So the seven in the menorah in the temple,
yes,
is like a cycle of life. And the eight, like the eight lights and the 8 days of Hanukkah are going beyond. And just to understand what's the connection with Sukkot, the 70 bulls on Sukkot relate to the transformation of the nations of the world. In fact, in Gemara Avodah Zarah, the very first page, it talks about when Mashiach comes and the discussion with the nations of the world, and God will say to the nations of the world, I have a simple little mitzvah, the sukkah. Go and see if you'll keep that. So the whole idea of Sukkot and the nations of the world are somehow fitting together with the idea that, first of all, there's a kind of a decrease of power, and then a transformation into something positive. That's the ultimate Hasidic perspective, that everything should be transformed into something positive, and even those forces which look like darkness should be transformed into light. Okay, Yossi, can you take that away with something illuminating? Thank everyone very much for participating, which makes the whole thing happen.
Were you up to Rosh Hashanah Chazal?
I'm up to.
I don't know. Maybe
well,
Rabbi
I've got a bookmark, so then it's a little tiny of black. I'm up to whether it goes Bossa Lakita.
Thanks very much.